So here we are at the end, well, not quite at the end, but coming towards the end of our third full day together. I don't know if you're like me, but I am starting to forget which day is which. And how long have we been here? Is this how it's going to be for forever? Maybe that entices you, maybe that meets you with dread. Or maybe both at different times. I don't know if you've been noticing the kind of changes through the days here. I guess from this position and having been on quite a few retreats before, it's a real pleasure to kind of track a little bit how the atmosphere seems to change through a retreat. And I've been sensing quite a lot of settledness. There's probably a noun there somewhere. And a really beautiful quality to the silence. And a kind of sense for me that there's a sort of connecting or harmonising or somehow kind of getting used to being here in this setting in Gaia House, you know, between us and Gaia House and each other, like a harmonious settling. And I'm aware that that really won't be how it feels internally or even externally for many of us all the time. And there are times when there's a lot going on, in fact. And I've been really grateful to hear a bit of people's experiences in the small groups, both here at Gaia House and online. And hello to the online Sangha. And you know, there's a lot that's been happening over these days, I think in us all. And I was thinking about what to offer tonight. I had a instinct to kind of go a little bit again to an overview sort of perspective. And apologies, I'm going to have to keep taking glasses on and off. I think this means I'm going to need to look for varifocals soon. So in the initial couple of days of this retreat, there was an emphasis from us and how to help us all land here with the busyness and the tiredness that kind of inevitably really follow us from our daily lives. And, you know, that takes time, and it may still be, you know, in the process of happening now, today. But it may be that you might be noticing that some of that is subsiding at times, and that you may be noticing more sensitivity developing, and maybe some periods which are pleasant or a bit quieter, or you know, there's some interest or something feels a little bit freeing perhaps in the mix of other experiences. And often what happens is that other patterns, other experiences arise in that space as well. You know, perhaps other things that we have been touched by or affected by in our lives, but you know, the busyness has obscured them. and they become a bit clearer on retreat. Or we're kind of triggered by things on the retreat itself and we have quite strong reactions, stronger perhaps than we understand or would anticipate. I think this is part of the sensitization process, and that there's a bit more space really for things to be felt, for the heart to respond, and for our patterns, whatever they are for us, our psychological and reactive patterns, to in some ways become more visible. So sometimes that means at this point in a retreat it's harder, you know, bigger things are coming up. And that would all be normal as well. So in the first couple of days, the emphasis in our teaching has been on ways to find some stability, some refuge, some resource in ground. We've been emphasizing the ground a lot, in the body, in the breath, finding an anchor, a place to that we can bring our attention back when it's doing its thing. In other realms, we've got somewhere to come back to, and we've been encouraging that place to come back to hopefully be a nourishing place, or to find aspects of it that feel nourishing and pleasant, so it's easier to come back. And this, the intention here has been to help us to settle and find some resource, some place that we can place our attention that is supportive, in contrast perhaps to wherever else our minds might go automatically. And loosely kind of speaking, and these categories are always a bit broad and don't really accurately describe all the nuances of practice and our experience, but broadly speaking, I'm saying there were two main kind of intentions within our tradition of insight meditation in terms of the meditation practice. Well, and I would say three, because the heart qualities and metta and compassion are all part of it as well throughout the whole process. But they particularly support this intention that I'll call samatha or samatha, which some of you will be aware of that word. And that's the part of meditation that is about calming, simplifying, finding nourishing resources within us that over time and with ups and downs and lots of hindrances a lot of the time tend to lead to harmonizing of the body and mind in a pleasant way over time. And some people here, I am aware of, are familiar with breath meditation in quite small focuses, like the nose, for example. And I haven't really practiced that style of meditation myself very much, but my understanding is that style of meditation and other quite specific breath focuses are really emphasising the samatha part of meditation, and can lead to quite calm states of mind. And it's a whole practice path in and of itself. And if people are interested particularly in this style of meditation, there are resources we can point you to if you want to go further. In this retreat and in the insight tradition and more generally, this samatha part of meditation is there to nourish us and support us, and also to support insight, the second intention of meditation, to understand our experience more. clearly and more deeply. And the settledness and calmness of the Samatha can really give us enough space and clarity to start to investigate our experience and understand it more. The story of the Buddha kind of is a story of his journey through some of these styles of meditation, and he became very adept at a kind of samatha practices that were around at his time, and he was highly skilled at them. But what he noticed was that these very beautiful states of mind and heart were not permanent, and that they would pass, and that he would still have difficult experiences and dissatisfaction. And his quest was really to understand the origins of suffering and dissatisfaction, this whole spectrum, as River spoke about, between sort of slight dissatisfaction and severe suffering and everything in between. Is why does this happen? And he used the power really of his samatha practice to turn towards investigating his experience, and through that he started to see more clearly how and why suffering can arise in the human mind. And it was that insight that really took him to his liberation. So insight practice is what is sometimes called vipassana, a kind of seeing more deeply. And practicing this can enable us to access some freedom, some ease and freedom, which is not so dependent on our conditions helping us be calm. And you may have, of course, noticed that life tends not to be that calm quite a lot of the time, and that we have many challenges that meet us in life, and that it's not possible necessarily to just get away from them and calm ourselves down. The calming style of meditation can really increase our resourcefulness, saying that, and can really help us not be so impacted. And there is a beautiful metaphor that the Buddha used of a salt in water, and how the samatha style of practice and metta and the Brahmaviharas can be like So let's say the untrained mind would be like a glass of water with a salt crystal, and the water is extremely salty in that case, with a big salt crystal. But with these practices of samatha and the Brahmaviharas, it's like that water grows into a vast lake, and the same salt crystal that drops into that lake doesn't have such an impact. You could hardly taste the salt, or perhaps you couldn't. So there is something to be said for doing these nourishing practices. They're really important, and they can increase our resource, increase our capacity. But in and of themselves, they don't necessarily help us understand our reactive patterns, why we get caught, when we get caught, what we can do about that. And that is one of the themes really for this retreat, and I copied a quote from Yanai's description of this retreat that I really loved. Through understanding the nature of things, we can come to know what it means to awaken in the midst of our life, to be deeply connected to our existence, and yet not bound by it. To be deeply touched by our world and able to respond to it. Through understanding the nature of things, we can come to know what it means to awaken in the midst of our life, to be deeply connected to our experience and yet not bound by it, to be deeply touched by our world and able to respond to it. Yana is pointing to how, through understanding the nature of our experience, we can cultivate, develop the ability to still be connected and yet less bound, less carried away by automatic reactivity. And that can enable us to be touched by our world and rather than react, to be able to respond to it from our wisdom and compassion. So I've been talking about Samatha and Vipassana as if they're two separate things. In some ways they are, and in some ways they're not. And they do tend to co-arise and support each other. And a metaphor a teacher used from the Thai tradition, Ajahn Chah, a really senior Thai master, who is the teacher of some of our teachers, or was, he's no longer with us. He had a metaphor for Samatha and Vipassana, a candle. We've got these lovely candles here, a big candle lit. And he said the Samatha is like the candle. The more accomplished, the more we have developed resource in our body, heart and mind through those practices, it's like we've got a really big, thick candle, has a lot of capacity within it. And Vipassana is like the flame, and both are needed to produce steady wisdom. So I have seen both already arising on this retreat, in people's reports from the small groups, both here and online, and in my own experience. So we've been emphasising, you know, the anchor and nourishing practices and a little bit of the insight. And what people are reporting is that, you know, for some people, that they're seeing the hindrances more clearly for what they are. They're being carried away with them less than they would have been. So that recognition of something like a hindrance of aversion already unpicks us, unbinds us to a degree from its power to be lost in it and carried away in it. And my sense is the resource that we're building up together through our practice together has enabled enough space to be able to see these things more clearly. Other people have been reporting, you know, that they're seeing their thought patterns more clearly and seeing them more as habits of mind and less as truth. And some people have been reporting how, you know, they've been feeling their emotions but and seeing them pass and not being as caught in additional layers of difficulty with their emotions, particularly around self-judgment, which is something we've been speaking to quite a lot. So maybe the resource of the practices that we've been exploring so far, plus some tools to recognise patterns, means that people are perhaps fairly naturally starting to recognise things and be less bound by them. So I'm going to go a little bit more into the Vipassana now. So the Buddha taught that difficulties, suffering and distress, and in fact not just that, but all experience arises dependent on conditions. Nothing arises just independently on its own, which is a bold statement, maybe something you'd like to check out in your own experience. So the Buddha was quoted as saying, "When there is this, that is. With the arising of this, that arises. When this is not, neither is that. With the cessation of this, that ceases." That might sound a little mysterious or just a bit obvious, I'm not sure. Maybe both. So, to look into this a bit more, why is he talking about this and that and not this and not that? So the teachings track some of the conditions that co-arise to produce reactivity. I'm going to sort of describe this in a more simple way that I find easier to articulate and understand. But this is referring to the teachings called dependent origination, which are in some ways quite complex teachings. But they're also, I find, also quite make common sense to me, and in some ways can be quite easy to see some of these aspects. So it's not exactly a linear, like this happens, then that happens in a path. It can be that lots of things sort of arise together. And I'm going to give some examples. So sometimes the first thing that I'm aware of or that perhaps was the first thing to happen, and it's hard to say what happens first sometimes, is the example I gave on the first night of tiredness on retreat, which I suspect many of you now experience. So the tiredness wasn't just a neutral, "Oh, there's a bit of tiredness here." Whatever that is, that experience of tiredness. But there was an unpleasantness to it, what I call a feeling tone, or in the traditions called Vedana. So basically, it was a state of heart and mind that was unpleasant. And therefore, I didn't like it, and I didn't want it. And in the not wanting of it were thoughts that came in as well, which were, "Why am I like this? What's wrong? How do I solve it as a problem? And what does this say about me?" And the thoughts arising that this will last forever, I'm not a good meditator, I shouldn't come on retreat. So the thoughts easily proliferate and start to focus around me and who I am and my identity. And really, perhaps the origin of it all was just that I was a bit tired. But it's kind of grown into something else. So this is an example of when this arises, that arises. And particularly in this psychology of Buddhism, when unpleasantness arises, pretty much most of the time, an aversion arises with it. And usually with aversion arise other reactions as well, and usually some kind of view of myself. And it all kind of arises together. And I might not be aware of much of that process except that I don't want to be here. And that might actually be the main thing in my mind, you know. I'm going to give some other examples. A different example is a thought. So in the Buddhist tradition, sensation and sense contact, which with tiredness was in my body and mind. In this example, it's a thought, and in Buddhist psychology, thought is a kind of sensation. I'm trying to think of a concrete because it's a bit theoretical as I've written it. A concrete example I'm in a retreat centre and I drop a plate and it breaks. That's the event, which of course has lots of sensations attached to it. But the main thought is that I've made a mistake. And quickly other thoughts follow, like, it's my fault. And you can probably see where this is going. You know, I'm a teacher. I've dropped a plate. What does that say about my mindfulness? And perhaps, and I'm adding another layer here, there's an underlying tendency from my past to feel an exaggerated sense of guilt, which now has a wonderful opportunity to really be fed by what's just happened. So I start to feel really, really guilty for doing something and upsetting other people, perhaps, or making a mess, or whatever it is. And and that when I've had this experience of this exaggerated guilt, the feeling is so profound in my body, it almost like takes me over and it becomes the problem I have to solve. It's like, how do I solve this guilt? And usually by explaining to myself why I'm so bad, so that it explains the feeling. Well, that's how it used to be. So all of those thoughts I'm putting in the realm of sensation and emotion as a kind of sensation. So not surprisingly, all of that is unpleasant and that I have aversion to it. I want it to go away and I'm trying to fix it, which is generating even more thoughts, which generates more unpleasant sensation and more aversion and more thoughts. And in the mix are arising quite powerful self-views about who I am, who I should be, who I'm not. I'm not like that teacher who never breaks plates. I'm going to give one another different experience, something that perhaps was lovely that led to suffering. I don't know, it feels like quite a trivial example, but it had quite a powerful impact on me when it happened. So I'm hoping it is something that will resonate with some of you. So I was here on retreat as a work yogi. I think I was painting a window in an area where there were some pot plants. And another work yogi came in to tend to the pot plants. And it was, you know, really lovely seeing her looking after the pot plants. And sort of my reaction was a bit like this. I wish I was tending the pot plants. I really don't like painting. Why can't I be the plant yogi? I really want to be the plant yogi. I should be the plant yogi. Why am I always doing something I don't want to do? Why is someone else always doing what I do want to do? This is always happening to me. I'm always going to be unhappy. I'm never going to be doing what I want to do. So do you see some of the layers in that reaction? It was being played out in thoughts. So the initial experience was actually a lovely experience, but then I had a kind of clinging wanting to it, so that there was a pleasant feeling tone, then I clung to it, not so much in this case wanting the pleasant feeling to continue, but wanting the object that I saw was the origin of the pleasant feeling, and I wanted it so badly that it instantly made me completely dissatisfied with what I was doing. I think before this lovely yogi came in to water the plants, I wasn't hugely enjoying painting, but it wasn't that bad. But by the time she left, I absolutely hated it. And this whole thing had been constructed about, you know, just like my vocation in life. Why, you know, it's to do with plants and nature. Why can't I find myself in those situations more fully? And no doubt, you know, activating other things that I've thought about in the past that it reminded me of, and it all kind of came into my mind. So there was pleasantness, there was clinging, there was wanting, and that created a dissatisfaction gap with the present moment, which got worse as I went round my Papancha thinking cycle. And very quickly in all of that was a self-view about who I was and who I wasn't and who I wanted to be and who I might never become. And so it goes into the future as well. And these patterns can also go into the past as well at the time. And I wonder, you know, in an average day, how many patterns like these, you know, flow through us? And how much we're kind of ricocheting, really, between trying to not feel difficult feelings and trying to feel pleasant feelings and constantly trying to manipulate our environment and what we do to try and keep it at a kind of equilibrium or a kind of position that we like. And that's kind of the reactivity of what we might call an untrained mind in Buddhist tradition, is that it's so automatic we might not even realise we're doing it, you know. And that in that is a restlessness. You know, we can't really rest in the present moment and really enjoy it for what it is. And it's interrupting our ability to actually maybe see a difficulty or an issue and actually be able to access a more heartful, wise response. And of course, if there's a very strong trigger, usually the reactions are much stronger as well. Although it's interesting how strong the reactions can be over small things as well, as perhaps my example showed, particularly on retreat, interestingly. So, in terms of unbinding from these difficult patterns, the really sort of central tool in our tradition is mindfulness. And it's this capacity to be aware of what is happening without being fully lost in it. So sort of a conscious awareness of it. And there becomes a little bit of a distance from it in that awareness. And as part of that capacity to be mindful and to recognise and to investigate and explore, it's really essential, really, that there is some heartfulness, there's some kindness in the mix that allows us to draw near enough to look and see more what is happening. Because I think one of the Buddha's core insights into the cause of suffering is that woven into many of our moments is a subtle dissatisfaction with it, of not wanting or wanting to change it in some way to kind of, you know, tweak it to make it more what we'd like. And what mindfulness practice can help us do is disentangle a little bit from that energy enough to be with something, enough to start to ride through those waves of perhaps wanting to change it or not liking it, to start to create some heartful space to see it more. So as I sort of outlined in the examples from the groups on this retreat, often, you know, to have the capacity to start to see a hindrance as a hindrance, we need that distance from it and a sense that it's okay to do this, or it's even a helpful or a kind thing to do. So recognition, mindful recognition, is such a powerful tool, and one which then allows us to move into considering some response of what's going to be most beneficial, most kind, most meet the needs of this situation, not from an immediate, quick, make myself feel better, but from actually, what does this really need? And a really powerful place to apply this mindfulness is at the level of the pleasant, unpleasant. because the teachings suggest that almost all experience will have, or maybe every experience has, some kind of feeling tone to it, of pleasant or unpleasant, or something in between, very subtly pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral seeming. But it's upon that which we will then usually have a reaction of wanting, not wanting. But if we become aware of the unpleasantness, or we can simplify what's happening more to that level, it's possible to start to ride those waves of unpleasant without them getting so built up into something bigger. So, for example, that episode with the painting and the pot plants, you know, it was on retreat and I could see more clearly what was happening than I would do normally. And I saw some of my thought process and I thought, wow, look at that. But I still felt a bit disturbed by it and sad and frustrated. So then there was the, you know, once I'd finished the job and I can't remember, after the incident anyway, there was the, well, okay, well, what is really happening here? And how does it feel in my body, on my heart, and what does this really need right now? And some tender care and some compassion for not judging myself for that pattern, because this just happens all the time, and it's what being human is, really, to experience these things. And it's like, oh yeah, there it was again, and it's okay, you know, I'm okay, it will be okay. And, you know, as it passed, you know, later in the day, it really wasn't a problem. You know, this lady had the job and I had a different job. The irony of it is that just a couple of weeks later, I was given the plant job. And it was nice, but it wasn't amazing. So that was quite a lesson. So we've already offered some practices around working with thoughts that I think are really helpful, and it's so powerful to have mindfulness of thoughts and to see a thought as a thought, not necessarily ultimate truth, you know, and it's likely to change, sometimes very quickly. And beneath thoughts, particularly powerful thoughts, there are emotions usually kind of driving them, and that can be a helpful way to investigate difficult thoughts. Sometimes it's like, oh, what's the emotion behind this thought? Mindfulness of emotions. Maybe there's sadness, or maybe there's anger. Or, well, what does that need? You know, maybe not to immediately lash out at that person or judge myself, but actually maybe this needs a different kind of attention and to be recognised and valued and given the attention the emotion needs rather than acting the thought out. And, you know, as part of an emotion, there'll be a bodily experience, and sometimes emotions are quite challenging to be with, as I'm sure you know. Sometimes it's easier to feel it more on a bodily level, like, what is this doing with my body? Is there heat? Is there tingling? Is there energy surging through my body? Is there a kind of, for sadness, I often feel it's like something kind of contracting a little bit in my chest. And we can ask, you know, what does my body need to be with this? Maybe it needs more space, more openness, maybe a tender touch, maybe some exercise, maybe going to a quiet place and yelling. You know, maybe the body needs to release some tension. So in that way, we're not acting out whatever world we've created in our heads to do with me and another. We're bringing it back down to a simpler level and meeting the need at that level. And because when this arises, that arises, and when this ceases, that ceases, if the body changes, almost always, in my experience, the emotion changes. And if the emotion changes, almost always the thoughts change. So any kind of kind influence at any of these levels will have influence at all the other levels. And through doing this and seeing this time and time again, we start to realise the instability of our heart, mind, head states. They're very unstable and they're changing a lot, much more than we often realise. Which also means that when we're in a difficult state, we know more that it will pass and it might be less believable, you know, that this will last forever, was forever, will be forever. Actually, it changes, and we see that again and again. And that links to the, you know, the truth of impermanence, which is a very, very freeing kind of realisation, process of realisation, probably for all one's life. And I just wanted to mention, you know, going back to Yamo's quote, through understanding the nature of things, we can come to know what it means to awaken in the midst of life, to be deeply connected to our experience and yet not bound by it, to be deeply touched by our world and able to respond to it. I was just reflecting just how much our world needs people to be touched by it, who can respond to it. You know, how in these times of huge challenge with climate, with environment, with social problems, with cost of living crises, with just challenges at all levels, really, of our world, what a gift to the world it could be to be someone that has a little bit more freedom to be able to come close to these challenges and offer something of their kindness and wisdom to it. And that both these practice traditions of Samatha that build our resource, we need that nourishment, we need places of refuge, we need places of safety to be able to come into contact with what is difficult, to not get lost in our reactive patterns blindly. Both these practice traditions are so important to be able to give us tools to respond more wisely in our world. So sometimes it can maybe feel a bit like, why am I here? It's sort of cut off from the rest of life. It would be nice to stay, but what would it be like to live a life in a retreat centre, even if it was possible? You know, and that, you know, is some people's path. But also these practices, they are very much about how to, they can support us living in the world, just as the Buddha himself did, and I think River mentioned, engaged with kings and politicians and tried to prevent wars, and he was very involved, as well as having time on retreat away from it all as well. So I just thought I'd finish with a poem, which is a bit of a story, which is from another time. It's from the time of the early nuns, the first nuns, really, of the Buddhist tradition. And some of the earliest writings that come to us are from these nuns. And, you know, in the time of what we know of those times, what I know of those times, is the place of women was quite challenging, and they didn't have many rights, you could say. And it was quite revolutionary for there to be nuns at all in the Buddha's Sangha. And these women were very varied. You know, some were had been slaves. Some had been mistresses and prostitutes. And some were princesses. And this poem is written by a princess, So she's called Sumedha, which means great wisdom. And she's describing the time she first heard of the Dharma and a little bit about how she left her household. And she's describing it to her nuns with her. So I think from the poem, I kind of imagine they're there in the evening, maybe a bit like this. It's not quite yet dark. They're in a forest grove and they're all gathered around and they're listening to Sumedha telling them a story of her own life. And she says, "I was wearing a new white dress on the morning I first heard the Dharma. Something was calling, but I couldn't quite make it out. I started spending more and more time alone in my room. One morning over breakfast, my mother asked me, 'What's going on?' So I told her. And my mother said, 'The Buddha's path isn't easy to follow, especially for someone accustomed to getting whatever she wants. Marry the good king Anikadatta. Enjoy all the things young ladies enjoy, dressing up, being waited on, and going to expensive parties, like weddings.' But Sumedha replied in the first person, 'Today you want to dress this body up and sell it at a wedding, but soon enough they'll be selling it to the graveyard for nothing. We are cows chasing the axe. We are soft flesh chasing the cobra's fangs. We are dry straw chasing the torch. We are lovers chasing our own reflections. My parents watched,' she says to her nuns, 'as I took a long sharp knife and cut off my long black hair. And just then, King Anikadatta walked in. He looked at me, blade in one hand, a couple of feet of hair in the other. Then he smiled. "With your hair cut short, Sumedha, you look even more beautiful. Soon all the women in our kingdom will be cutting their hair just like yours. Come, my love, the whole world is chasing happiness. You and I will be among the lucky few who win the race." "Good king," I said, "if we spend our lives running after the things of the world, we will die and keep right on running, stealing the things we mean to earn, setting fire to the things we mean to protect, drowning the people we mean to love, and turning into enemies those most like ourselves." I threw my hair to the ground. Anikadatta knelt down, picked up a few strands and let them fall. Then he stood and turned to my parents and he said, "You who would have been my mother, you who would have been my father, let Sumedha go. May she find the path and may she one day return to show us all the way home." And then Sumedha turned to her sister nuns. "It's getting dark now, my sisters. The sun's going down, and soon we'll all be going our separate ways. Can we sit here together just a little while longer, not saying anything at all? The path will go on rising and falling like a song. And in the end, you will find yourself as one lost at sea finds herself, finally washed ashore. Listen. Can you hear that? The sound of the wind in the leaves, like a wave coming on. Go on. Shake up the world. Set yourself free." just take a few moments in silence.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.